Podcasting from Honolulu, Hawaii, the most beautiful place to live, where beaches and sunsets take your breath away, and the Aloha spirit is the steadfast and inclusive community development tool of the islands. This is the CRA Podcast, a podcast committed to highlighting the great work across the nation in transforming communities through the power of economic development and the Community Reinvestment Act. And now, here's your host and CRA enthusiast, Linda Lewis-Izuka.
Welcome to the CRA Podcast. I'm Linda Lewis-Izuka, your host and founder of CRA Today. This podcast is part of my mission to transform communities through the power of economic development and the Community Reinvestment Act. As some of you know, I am very passionate about community development financial institutions, or otherwise known as CDFIs. They are a powerful tool within the continuum of credit spectrum that is strategically deployed within disadvantaged communities. CDFIs partner with banks and other community development entities to realize the power of partnerships for impact. Today, I have the distinct honor to talk with one of our legends of community development and the CDFI movement, Mark Pinsky. Mark is a strategic leader, thinker, and author who has advised 3 presidential administrations, 16 Congresses, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and a plethora of community development financial institutions, banks, and nonprofit organizations. Most of you might know Mark from when he led the CDFI industry as president and CEO of Opportunity Finance Network. During his leadership, CDFIs expanded to play an influential role in a diverse range of fields, including healthcare, education, housing, small business, corporate social responsibility, financial policy, and transportation. He also played a central policy role in the 1990s in the creation of the CDFI Fund within the Department of Treasury, and later played a significant role in creating the New Markets Tax Credit Program, the CDFI Bond Guarantee Program, the Capital Magnet Fund, and the Small Business Loan Fund, among other programs. In 2011, he led the development of the Create Jobs for USA in partnership with Starbucks, Google, Banana Republic, and others, and participated in the development of the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses and the Communities at Work Fund with Citigroup. I can go on and on with more examples of his extraordinary work, but I just can't wait for you to hear about his CDFI-friendly cities initiative and his deep thoughts on community development. So with that, let's get started. So welcome to the CRA Podcast, Mark.
Thank you. It's wonderful to join you.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So in my circles, you're an urban legend. I am curious to learn.
Hopefully not an urban myth. I don't know.
let's stick with legend. I am curious to learn when and how you were first introduced and exposed to community development and CDFIs.
It's a long time ago now, but I literally stumbled my way into this world. And for these many years later, I get asked often by young, brilliant, talented people who want to find their way into the field what the career path is. And I tell them, don't follow mine. Because my career path was that my wife's best friend from high school was visiting town, and he was going out with a woman whose sister was married to the guy who had the job before me. So that's how right. That's how I found my way into this industry. But I had been searching for it and not knowing that, which is to say, I came out of college in 1979, right after the Three Mile Island nuclear power accident. Got involved in. I'd always had been interested in being involved in advocacy and policy, and went to Washington to work on what we then called safe energy issues, we might now call them green issues, and did that, went to work on Capitol Hill, and that became really important because I had, although not a lot, I had a few years of Capitol Hill experience, which would later turn out to be 3 years more than anybody else in the CDFI industry. And went to New York and did public policy work, co-edited what was going to be a public policy book for in 1987, co-edited what was going to be a public policy book for the Dukakis administration, which didn't turn out so well. And but in the process, I met some really interesting people, including the guy who wrote the introduction for that book was an Arkansas governor named Bill Clinton. And so I stumbled, it was 1989 when I stumbled into the CDFI industry, as I told you. And I had been looking for a place that was as disciplined about its use of wealth and money as it was about it, as disciplined and determined about its sense of mission. And I came upon my predecessor, a guy named Martin Trimble, who inspires me to this day. He's a community organizer to this day. And I thought literally my first moment I met him, I thought he's either, you know, a lunatic or a brilliant inspired genius.
A little bit of both.
You know, most people are. But he was really the person who brought me, sort of mentored my way into this industry. And he brought me in, I did a little public policy work. And then along came this thing called, Bill Clinton was running for president and decided he wanted to create this thing that we now call the CDFI Fund, which has played a big role. And that's where my experience came in. I had 3 years of experience on Capitol Hill among a group of people who thought generally that anything having to do with Washington, D.C. was dirty and ugly and they didn't want anything to do with it. So I had a running head start and I was able to sort of play a role in really just coordinating a lot of brilliant people doing remarkable things that no one thought was supposed to be possible. And we were good. We got lucky and we created this thing called the CDFI Fund. So when Martin left, and he was, as I said, he was a community organizer. When he left what's now Opportunity Finance Network, when he left to go back to community organizing, because he was an organizer, he had done the job. The board came to me and invited me to apply and my future was sealed. So that's how I got into this stuff. I had to learn along the way. I didn't read financials when I came in. And I didn't know much of the history, but I was fortunate to be around the people that like you, and like Maurice and like others who have been really thinking hard about this for a long time and are really generous about sharing their knowledge and their expertise and their perspective. And without that, I never would have made it.
Wow. One of the pioneers in the CDFI movement from the very beginning.
Almost.
Well, yeah. Closer than many of us. So
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I think that's actually really significant to sort of try. I mean, one of the great things I have is the historical perspective. I always call myself Generation 1B, the 1A before me, the people who really founded it. And they are, if you go back to the earliest days of this industry, there was a really rare and not replicable critical mass of brilliance. Whether the people like Jeremy Nowak and Martin Eakes and Julie Eads up in New Hampshire, Dan Liebson, who was in California at the time, and a lot of other folks, Chuck Mathai, who people don't remember today, but is probably the most important of anybody from the earliest days. And there was just this remarkable grouping of folks, all of whom were determined to figure out how to learn to manage money, to create a sense of community, to create an ability for communities to control their own fate. Nobody had any idea of what it was going to become. But it went over time. I literally remember the phone call, the very first person who called me in 1995 and said, geez, I want to have a career in the CDFI industry. And I thought, well, that's a novel idea.
industry.
What's that? I do too. How do you do that? Now there's this remarkable inflow of young, talented people who have more financial skills than any of us ever had, that have grown up with a sense of mission that felt
a natural. Moral compass. Amazing.
Yeah, a moral compass.
Yeah.
And are determined and dedicated and have no doubt that they're ready to change the world. And that's a remarkable thing. It's a gift to me from my perspective, that I was able to sort of experience some of that and meet some of these people along the way.
I can't wait for Generation Z to be in it, to be steeped in it, and to see what will be produced and what outcomes we can achieve through just the next generation, leveraging so much that we didn't have, and the reach, right, through some of the newer tools too, right, through social media and whatnot. So
absolutely.
Our ability to connect is so much more immediate, obviously, than it was before when we started. started this work. So, with that said, I read an interesting statistic that surprised me, that more than a quarter of counties in the U.S. have had no CDFI lending in the 5 years between 2011 and 2015. And this is per the Urban Institute. They're an industry leader in CDFI research. So this surprised me. Now, you know better, but I really assumed that our CDFIs, being the robust sector that they have become now, are really well integrated into our larger financial services, our financial services industries. And I really assumed that they were well dispersed across the nation after all of these years. So that statistic indicates that it's not true. So what are some of the barriers to the CDFI work in underserved counties?
Yeah, it's a really interesting statistic, and good for the Urban Institute for sort of framing it that way. I'm surprised that it's not a higher percentage that aren't served. And a little bit that comes with some historical perspective, because it wasn't very long ago that we thought that, you know, if someone held up a flag and said, hey, CDFIs are in town, that no one would notice, you know, it was sort of right. And over time they've become, good at what they did. And then they became relevant to local markets and the local financial institutions and the governments. And, you know, that's changed over time. But if you were to map, if you were to do a weighted map of CDFI financing in every market in the United States, you'd have to zoom in really, really, really close to even be able to see it. It's not big. I mean, now the industry's grown. I mean, when I got involved in the industry, we were less than $1 billion. Now we're 130, 140 billion, depending on who you believe. That sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But the reality is it's a blip in a much, in a $100 trillion economy. And that's okay if you understand what the role of CDFIs are and are not. The challenges are that we have a business model in the CDFI world that's meant to be profitable but not profit maximizing. And inherent in that model is a challenge to scaling what you do. There is a friction, a capital friction, if you will, in trying to get things done when you're doing it that way. And I think that both is a constraint in the sense it means you can't reach more people in more communities, but it's also one of our strengths. And so we need to, again, recognize who we are and who we're not. It's a strength because what it means is we have to be really disciplined in our strategy about who we are going to serve and who we're not going to serve, right? Mm-hmm. Who's going to benefit the most? Where do you get the most bang for the buck? This came up a lot in 2010 and 2011 during the recession when small businesses in this country couldn't get access to credit. A lot of them didn't get access to credit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of very established companies that we thought of as upmarket assets, would started calling CDFIs and saying, geez, I've been doing this business for 22 years I've had a revolving line of credit with my bank, and I just went to draw on it, and they said, "Sorry, we're not doing that anymore." Right, and so CDFIs had to then decide in some way: do I lend to this business that's been around that should be bankable, that the bank should be serving, because they employ 9 people in our communities? It might be a small retail business, but it's 9 people. That's a lot of jobs, right? It's a lot of lives, and it ripples through families. Right. Or do I provide a little startup money to this entrepreneur who has a great idea for a business, but it's risky, but lost their job because of what happened in the economy, right?
And the ripple effect of that, of course.
Yeah. Right. And so, so CDFIs have to be strategically agile and really smart and really disciplined, as I said earlier, about their, about what they do every day. And that's one of our assets. So, what goes along with that in being just a small part is that you have an ability to have an outsized leverage over what other people do, right? And so if you go back to some years ago, we did a partnership with Starbucks called Create Jobs for USA and raised a lot of money and got more publicity. We got a billion media impressions.
Yeah.
Of course we did it. Never in our wildest dreams.
Right.
We had fantasies, but never in our wildest dreams did we think that was going to happen. And the challenge there was helping everybody understand the reason for doing that wasn't to make sure that every small business in the country could get access to a loan. but that there was no reason that they weren't getting access to a loan, to demonstrate what was achievable and doable. And that's a role that CDFI should play, and they should leverage by the gravitational pull of their practice, and not just by the amount, the volume of lending that they do. So.
That campaign, I recall, it was, I was so impressed to walk into my local Starbucks and to see CDFI, you know, the acronym in a Starbucks stunned me. And I it was so nice to be able to explain it to those that were next to me, if they were interested, that, you know, we just continued the conversation just by the mere fact of that card being up by, you know, where your barista stands.
It was unbelievable. I will tell you, actually, in 2012, I guess it was, when we were doing, no, it was before that, 2009, we were doing strategic planning. And one of the goals we had actually set was that the CDFI industry would be featured among a big company in a Super Bowl ad. That was our goal. And here we were in 2000, what was that, 2011, 10, 11? I can't remember now. I think it was 11. Uh-huh. And we announced Create Jobs for USA in an ad on Game 7 of the World Series with 23 million people watching, right?
Wow.
And I just decided to declare victory. You know, that was year one of the strategy. We wanted to get to the Super Bowl in year 15. I have no doubt about that by now. Uh-huh. But, you know, and yeah, but it raised people's awareness. But what was really important, I mean, the folks, I just had a conversation with someone very close to Howard Schultz, who was at Starbucks at the time. Yep. And, you know, they said Howard was like, you know, do we have to call them CDFIs? Isn't there, you know, and you know, and how they dealt with that. And they dealt with that by their brilliance of messaging to make people realize you don't even really need to know what a CDFI is, exactly. But you want to see it when you walk into Starbucks.
Right.
And that, you know, with the help of a company and a person like Howard and a company like Starbucks, I think that was very powerful at sending a message. There's this thing out there. There's this force out there we don't understand.
Exactly.
But it's telling us something, and we need to listen to it. And that's a way that CDFIs, even if we're not in all the markets. Having said that, even in the markets we're in, we're not in the markets full service, right? So maybe we do small business, but we don't do affordable housing. Or maybe we do affordable rental, but not affordable single family. And so, you know, the challenge is not just how do you have a physical presence in these places or do lending in each county, but how do you do lending that's really geared to meet all the range of needs, which are only growing in all the counties in this country.
We have a lot more work to do for sure.
Yeah.
So I recently read an outstanding white paper, and you happen to author it, focusing on this emerging concept called CDFI Friendly Cities. Yeah. So tell me more about the origins of this idea and why you're spending your nights, weekends, and your waking days, and perhaps a little sleeping hours, thinking about this concept.
So going back to that time that Urban Institute talked about, going back to the, you know, we came out of the recession much stronger and much more important to government and to mainstream financial institutions than we ever dreamed. We didn't think we were going to survive the recession, let alone be important. But it was really clear as soon as we went from being, you know, big fish in a little pond to being big fish in a big pond, or we were really little tiny fish in a big pond. Yeah. And it was really clear that gap that Urban talked about, it became really huge. And we called it the coverage problem, and it's been called other things over time, which is how do CDFIs cover these areas where they can't financially afford to be? You know, banks will talk about bricks and mortar costs. We have the same thing, right? I mean, having a person, it might make sense in Hawaii to have one person serving all the islands, but it might not make sense to have one person on each of the islands, right?
Exactly.
And that's, you know, that's true in different ways in different places. So I've been wrestling with that and just trying to figure out what to do about it. And in the process, I moved on. I, you know, left OFN and started doing my own projects and things that I was, you know, things that I didn't have space to do with in my OFN time. And one day I got a call it was late April, early May of 2017. And I don't remember what year we're in. And it was an old friend of mine, a guy named John Hamilton, who comes from the CDFI world, had created City First Bank and City First Enterprises in Washington, D.C., and was a somebody I really knew and respected. And he's now mayor of Bloomington, Indiana, which is where he was born and raised. And he said, you know, how are you? I said, great, how are you? He said, we want to start a CDFI here. Will you help us? And I said, I'll help you because you're my friend and I'm doing things now where I can help people who are my friends. But why do you want to start a CDFI? It doesn't sound like a very good idea. So, you know, hope.
Thanks, Mark.
This balloon, right? I made my whole career on popping balloons. So what can I say? But you know, if the balloon's not going to float, then why bother? You know, And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, how big is Bloomington? And he said, Bloomington's about 85,000 people. And I said, how many of them are students? And just under half of them are students. And, I said, and what do you want to lend for? He said, well, we need to lend for small business and affordable housing and rental and single family. And we have community facilities and we have commercial real estate. And, I said, yeah, you know, CDFIs in markets that size maybe can do one thing well. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard to do that. And, oh, by the way, it's really expensive to do that because not only do you have to, you know, you have to pay operating costs and they require a fair amount of subsidy, but you have to capitalize them. And so, you know, so we walked through that. And so he said, well, we've thought about all that. So we're thinking maybe we can, you know, in a sense, rent a CDFI. We can get a great CDFI from somewhere else to come in. I said, awesome. There's some great CDFIs. I'm happy to help you do it. You know, but you might need a few of them. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, suppose you get somebody who's good at creating community facilities, but you need to make a small business loan. So I said, there's a third idea, which I sort of been kicking around and I just made up the title at the moment. I said, what if you became America's first CDFI friendly city?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
He said, what do you mean? And I said, well, figure out how to use your resources and your public authority and your civic leadership, which Bloomington is very fortunate to have very rich and deep public leadership. Civic leadership, you know, from the private side as well as the public side. And I said, you use it instead of creating your own entity, figuring out how to create incentives and enhancements that make it easier for CDFIs who want to come into the market to come in. He said, all right, well, it's worth thinking about, but we're not going to give up on the other idea. So we went through a process in Bloomington where that was really, and this is the process that I'm using now in other places to sort of help them think about whether to be CDFI friendly communities or cities. Not all of them are cities. Some of them are rural. And it's a process first of just sort of taking an assessment of what's going on in the community. Part of that assessment is no matter how talented people are, the bankers in Bloomington are incredibly talented and smart and good. The commercial real estate people, are, you know, no matter how much they know, they don't know CDFIs.
Right.
Things we know from 30 plus years of CDFIs now is that CDFIs create their own markets to a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
They're more creative. They think about things differently. They see opportunities where other people see barriers. And so, so part of it was a conversation about that, but part of it was my job was to sort of hear from them what they really needed to do. I needed to figure out, A, were there real financing opportunities there, and B, were they appropriate to CDFIs? Because the next step then was we went out and talked to the CDFI industry. And I know the CDFI industry pretty well by this time. So I go out and say, this CDFI might be interested in talking to you for this reason. And that CDFI might be interested in talking to you. And it was incredibly informative. And we learned a lot. And the first thing and the biggest thing we learned was CDFIs jumped on this faster than I could have imagined. It took less than 5 seconds with everybody.
Well, was that your leadership and involvement?
What's that?
Was that your leadership and involvement?
No, I think it was. They're all sitting around saying, we're really good at what we're doing. We're serving this market well. We want to serve more markets, but we can't, you know, we can't absorb the bricks and mortar costs. We can't.
Right.
We need some help.
We would if we could.
And somebody came along and said, what if we tried to help you? And they said, we want to be part of that. And so we found, a dozen CDFIs that were interested in not only in looking at assets, looking at financing opportunities in Bloomington, but were willing to come to Bloomington in November for a meeting that we put together with the folks I talked to on the community side, folks I talked to on the CDFI side, as well as CDFI investors and funders, and have a conversation about it. We came out of that and the decision was, this is an idea with promise, let's do it.
Right.
So we're doing it.
So you had a great convening, and in your paper you said interest in CDFIs was high, the knowledge of the CDFIs was low, and that community was rich in talent and related expertise. Mm-hmm. So you merely brought them all together and figured out how to make it work, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, in my mind, I go back to the creation of the CDFI fund. You know, there wasn't anything magic. It was if you get people together and you say, hey, this person's really talented. You should talk to, you know, exactly. her.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, there's got to be an assessment that there's something to talk about.
Sure.
It wouldn't have worked if the skill sets weren't there in the background, you know. But it just seemed really clear that these people wanted to talk to each other. They just didn't know it. And
right.
so, and I think that that's true in a lot of other places who simply don't know. They've heard of these things called CDFIs. Maybe they've tried to start a CDFI.
Right.
Maybe they wish they could start a CDFI. But they don't really understand it. So one of the things that happened in Bloomington was I had the Bloomington community come up with what I call deal sheets, which was just, let's come up with 10 or more potential deals. You know, you write them up the way you see them. And then let's go take them to CDFIs and see if they say, you know, boring or if they say, yeah.
Are these hypotheticals or are these actually forming the pipeline?
They were forming pipeline.
Awesome.
And they were real deals. They were all things that they were trying to get done. Some of them, they've been trying for a decade or longer. Some mm-hmm. of them were new opportunities. Some mm-hmm. of them were, one of them was, there's this property, we're trying to figure out what to do with it. Mm-hmm. Which was a good, so it was a good mix. And so we had 14 when we brought the CDFIs together in November of 17. And every one of the deals was under discussion immediately.
Huh. Awesome.
Some are moving, some are not. Sometimes some of them are because CDFI interest is waning, some of them because the projects have slowed down. Sure. But they're moving, and we've identified probably another half a dozen in Bloomington. And that are now, some of which have moved to the front, that are in sort of very active conversation.
The nature of the beast, right? Yeah.
Some of them got done without CDFIs, which we consider a success because
Absolutely.
We think CDFIs help to prompt the interest in the activity. Mm-hmm. You know, the goal was to get the financing there, not to get the deals done.
Sure.
And so, you know, we're figuring out what it means to make the idea of a CDFI-friendly community the reality of a CDFI-friendly community. And
right.
This year is an experiment, and we're putting together a business plan and capitalizing a sort of a local CDFI-friendly community entity, and we're going to give it a run.
Great. So I want to explore how this is really different than place-based community development. So for the listeners newer to this concept of place-based community development, it's where philanthropic funders, financial institutions, federal and state agencies, nonprofits, and local community development agencies come together really as a way to concentrate investments in a specific location, to certainly achieve measurable community reinvestment or community revitalization results. So the most ambitious initiatives have aimed to concentrate multiple investments in both infrastructure and human capital in a single neighborhood, much like the group you brought together, right, in the place that you started. So I'm interested to learn how it's different, or is it the same?
They're on parallel tracks.
Oh, okay.
So community development historically was a place-based thing because it was a real estate-based thing. And so initially, if you go back to the early stages of community development, if you go back to the Gray Areas Project, the Ford Foundation did in New Haven in the 1950s and into the 60s, and then you look at some of the social programs that came out in the Great Society and all of that, they were primarily housing related, they were primarily real estate related, and they defined community in terms of place. There was less focus on defining, you know, the alternative is to define community in terms of common characteristics across a group of people. And, you know, both matter. Both work. Different people do different strategies. If, you know, for a lot of folks, some of them, they overlap. If you're trying to work on racial equity issues, or you're trying to work on Native or ethnic issues, national or ethnic issues, you know, you may have both at play, right? If you're doing financing on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, You have a people-based strategy and you have a place-based strategy, but it's a little bit different there than it was. So this is just a way of organizing supply and demand of financing in a place-based strategy. And they wrestle with place in Bloomington because Bloomington is the city hub of a region But the city's 85,000, the region's only 400,000. It's not a large area. And it's, you know, an hour from Indianapolis, which is a much bigger market, but they're very different in some ways. And so it's always a challenge to figure out how do you organize supply and demand of capital in a place like that. Right. And so this this gives some fluidity to it, or some options for supply and demand, because this doesn't say, you know, the old way, if you will, the old CDFI way, which is still valuable in a lot of places, is we're going to go open up shop in Bloomington and we're going to put somebody there and we're going to have an office, we're going to have overhead, and you got to place a big bet. You know, you got to ante up. And this says you don't have to ante up, right? You can come visit, and the CDFIs are there every week. There are CDFIs coming to town to sort of talk to people and look at deals, and just like you need to cultivate deal flow anywhere that you're doing lending,
right?
And pipeline, and you know, it lowers the entry cost and the cost of sort of acquiring your assets, and so it's really just an effort to facilitate the whole model is just to facilitate, in my mind, CDFIs who I, you know, love and believe in, and the work that they're trying to do into communities that need them. And I don't know all these communities. Bloomington's been very kind to me and very, you know, I enjoy being there, but you know, there are thousands, there are close to 20,000 communities in this country, cities and non-cities, urban and non-urban, that are under 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of places in this country that probably in most instances are not going to find it financially prudent to create their own CDFIs,
but
would benefit. Many of them would benefit from CDFI financing, maybe for the occasional deal. Some of them, maybe it's one deal a year, right? And that's never going to happen if you don't have
absolutely. So it's been a while since you've launched. So what mm-hmm. have you learned along the way, or what has surprised you, or what didn't go as you expected?
It's a great question. We didn't know what to expect, so it's easy to answer.
Right.
You know, it's been very smooth, and partly that has to do with the fact that Bloomington may be unique in this country in that it has a CDFI mayor.
Right. You know, how many of us can say that?
Yeah. How many places can say a former, you know, board chair, CEO right. of a CDFI mm-hmm. is now your mayor? That was, you know, it may be one and done. We may find this doesn't work anywhere else, you know, because, you know, we don't have John Hamilton there. But, you know, John's been great about it, but he understood that and understood that a big part of the job was helping others involved. We have a community foundation there, a community foundation in Bloomington and Monroe County, led by a woman named Tina Peterson, who's deeply invested in understanding not just CDFIs, but the role of, she's interested in mission-related investing and impact investing. And she's awesome. Interested as a leader in thinking about, you know, she has a responsibility to her board and to her donors, but also to figuring out how does she maximize the bang for the buck she can create. So she's interested in learning about this. So she's been a tremendous person. But it's also an unusual community in that, you know, people have disagreements there, but they're very collaborative and very, you know, I may find that's true in a lot of places, but it surprised me. I've been surprised by it. So what hasn't happened yet is there have been a few small deals that have closed, but I don't know that we've seen, I don't know that we could say we've leveraged a 10x expansion of financing. I think we will. Mm-hmm. We're setting pretty ambitious goals for what we can create over the next 5 years. One element that we really committed to is having a pool of capital that is an enhancement to CDFIs, much in the same way that CDFIs are often an enhancement to more mainstream sources of capital. So if a CDFI comes in, one of the problems, if you're not based in a community and you don't live there and you don't, you know, see people at, you know, church or the mosque or synagogue, or you don't see people in the grocery store or whatever,
right.
It's harder to keep track of things. And so so there's an element of risk that's a little bit different when you're not there. And,
right.
you know, a lot of CDFIs have gotten very good at doing that over distance. Historically, rural CDFIs in this country, and I'm going back to my beginnings in this industry, you know, 30 years ago, it's astonishing how good they are. They travel a lot, but they're astonishing right. how good they are right. at understanding how to mitigate risk and managers. Right. But, you know, there are deals where we've heard from CDFIs where they say, I just don't know, you know, early stage, I want some capital alongside me or underneath me when I start out. And if it works after a year, great. We'll, you're out, right?
Right.
And some of them have pricing issues and they're trying, you know, they don't, pricing just tells you, if you have pricing differences, it tells you you don't really agree on the risk, right? And so on the credit risk. And so, you know, there are those conversations. So we're in the process of setting up that fund. It was important that the mayor from the very beginning committed a couple million dollars of city money.
Yeah, and, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, and it's not all in place. I just had a call the other day. I think we've identified how we're going to do it, and it's just a matter, you know, take some time.
Great, but, things take time.
Yeah, but you know, but I think that hasn't happened yet, and I don't know how that's going to affect going forward. I think it's going to matter, and maybe we create this fund and nobody uses it. You know, who knows, right? We just don't know. But the other thing that surprised me on the other side of it is there have been a number of mainstream financial institutions, regional mainstream financial institutions, who said, when you set that fund up, I want in. I want to be part of it.
Okay.
And it's because they want to, they're a little bit at a distance. They're not the local banks. Sure. The local bankers, they're fabulous. And they want to be part of it, but they want to, you know, they don't feel part of it in the same way. They want to let the local banks be involved in the local level. And so It's figuring out the whole living organism that is a CDFI friendly community is something we're still doing. So we don't know. But I will say, in terms of learning lessons, one of the things that we're committed to doing, the mayor told me we're committed to last time I saw him, is we're going to do a year later meeting in November where we're going to invite folks to come, both the folks who were there last year, but other folks as well. And I have no doubt that the folks in Bloomington are going to be, you know, warts and all, are not going to be hesitant to sort of say, well, I thought this would happen and it didn't. You know,
okay.
I think it'll be a good opportunity, and we'll probably broadcast that out in some way so people can record it.
Are there any unexpected partners that came to the table, like any healthcare providers or anybody you would like to add, is another way of asking?
Yeah. No. Well, I think that every community is different in who its partners is. Bloomington is the home to Indiana University, I think it's called.
Oh, half the population are students. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. And so they're a major factor in anything that's going to happen in that community.
Okay.
So those conversations are still ongoing. They're absolutely at the table. They absolutely want to help. But when you say healthcare, one of the big challenges in Bloomington, when I walked in the door a year and a half ago, is that the Indiana University Health System was in the process of transferring ownership, selling ownership of its facility, main hospital facility, which is downtown, to the city at a significant discount, while it was in the process of breaking ground on a major new multi-billion dollar facility out on the edge of town, out near campus. Makes a lot of sense for them to do it. They, you know, so suddenly you have a large parcel of land right downtown with that's not like most, it's high rise. It's not like most, you know, 12, 13 stories. So there, it presents a huge development challenge in the city. And I think the city at the time was viewing it as, well, we're going to buy it for a discount. We're going to tear it down. We'll find a way to make use of the land. And I got to tell you, when we got the CDFIs to town on last November, they were just salivating at sort of, you can do this and you can do that. Because it's not just the property. You have all this, you know, you have additional land. You have all these outbuildings, all the medical offices, right?
Right.
And they have like 24 acres of medical offices that, you know, to repurpose those and think about what you could do for education or what you could do for, you know, residential or what you could do for small business or, you know, I mean, just, you know, their brains were spinning. They you know, believe me, they didn't want to stop talking that night. It was like, well, what if we did this? What if we did that? And so I think it was a matter of creating a real opportunity there. But I think that the university will be part of it. The health system will be part of it. And another actually happens college community that's reached out to me and that I've been talking with that I think will start this process sometime this fall. It's actually a private health system. It's not even a university health system that has taken the lead and is sort of the lead organizer, said, you know, who's come in first and said, we'll put in our money if others will put in money to help make this happen. Mm-hmm. And it's just the nature of the civic fabric of different places. They're all different. They're different leaders. And, you know this, you've worked in a lot of communities. Sometimes you just have someone who may be CEO of a health system who, frankly, is really just a community organizer at heart, right?
Absolutely.
And you use healthcare, or someone who's an insurance company or a bank or, you know, city government or, you know, a real estate, you know, anything, right? It's the
people. I love about this work.
It's yes. People. It's not the type of institution.
So right.
I'm excited. I mean, I think, you know, you mentioned the white paper. I can't wait 3 years from now to write the white paper about what we've learned from trying this in 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 different
places. Absolutely.
So Mark, can you tell me a little bit more about how our financial institutions were involved?
We had a really interesting experience, and I'll start by talking a little bit about the CDFI friendly communities idea, where how banks have responded. But then we can go back. I mean, the evolution of banks and the relationship to CDFIs has been one of the more interesting things in my life.
Be a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's going from, I will never forget the moment when we were just starting, would have been 1990, I almost said 2003, 1993, when we were starting to sort of work on the CDFI fund concept, when we did an event at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and whoever was speaking on behalf of the CDFI said, you know, our net charge-off rate is under 2%. And two of the bankers, not just one of the bankers, sitting behind me in the audience said, "You're lying," like out loud. I was like, whoa. I mean, I get you might think that, but really? And, you know, it's gone from this intense distrust and skepticism and not understanding to an incredibly collaborative, constructive set of relationships all across the country in urban, rural, and native communities. So, and I think that's the spirit of it. And so one of the things that we did when we were out doing the interviews and the outreach before we convened people was include in that not just CDFI, but CDFI investors and funders. Because we wanted to say, was this, you know, did they think this was going to be a good idea? Or was this going to be, you know, was this off the radar screen? And I will tell you that the major investors, so including the folks who came to that meeting were Bank of America and Wells and what other banks were there? KeyBank was there. A couple of PNC was there. Key and PNC are large regional banks. You know, it took the CDFI executive at Bank of America, Dan Latendra, it took him less time than it took the CDFIs to say, "I'm in." Yeah. You know, if you're doing this, I'm in. And it's partly because he wants to encourage CDFI activity. It's partly because this is a market, you know, Bank of America, for example, and Wells are not, you know, they don't limit what they do to their geographies. They do things based on, on what they think is good for the bank.
Impact. Amazing.
For impact. Yeah. It took a long time to get there, but they do it. And so they were there. And I will tell you that one of the most valuable things of that meeting in November was to have, we asked Dan Latendra at Bank of America, who's the largest investor in CDFIs in the country, just to come in and talk a little bit about how he thinks about investing in CDFIs. And he was smart enough to come in and talk to the bankers. You know, he wasn't trying to talk to anybody else. He was trying to talk to bankers.
Of course.
And it was very useful for them. I mean, and they talk about it to this day when I'm out there, when I'm out in Bloomington. They talk about, you know, that guy from Bank of America just really explained to me that this is how they think about risk, not that. And
I know. We need him everywhere. Talking to our bankers.
But, you know, folks from Wells were there, and that was important because they had done a whole – you know, they have the diverse community capital program that they do, which is aimed at serving, communities of color. And that was one of the topics that people wanted to hear about. Right. And so it was important that they were there and the regional banks were there. They're trying to figure out their focuses on main streets across middle America, you know, and what did this mean for them? And then the local banks were there too. And they're really wonderful community bankers. But it's Bloomington is a community that, partly because it's so collaborative, doesn't have a lot of, you know, they don't have contentious CRA fights there. They do things that they think are good for the community. And they were doing, you know, they were there to actively learn. They were trying, they knew their banks worked with CDFIs. They didn't know a lot about it, but they were, you know, they were trying to do everything they could. What they learned was there's more things they could do and they're committed to doing it. So, so it was very good in all those ways. I mean, I don't think we didn't have a bad reaction from a banker. We only had good reactions. I mean, the reactions were, geez, next time you come to town, Mark, can we sit down so I can better understand what CDFIs are doing in Wisconsin so that I can, or in, you know, Maine,
I can get
so that I can talk to my team. And can you talk to my, I mean, I got a whole series of conversations with the CRA teams up to the, you know, senior executives at various banks. Just trying to explain how this works.
Yeah, we need many voices there. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I find the people, especially the people on the CRA team, they're 100% committed to doing this. They want to understand, and they're bankers, and they should be. thoughtful about how they think about the risks and the opportunities.
Of course. So now I'm going to switch the gears up a little bit to wrap up our time together. Right. But I'd like to end this podcast with a little community development tips, tools, and I like to sprinkle it with a little inspiration. So my colleagues have great respect for your work and your leadership in the sector. So I know you have so much to share. So during your longstanding leadership and career in shaping the CDFI industry, what was most challenging for you?
Well, I appreciate that prelude. And I would just say that I feel like my the things I did that I was, and I wasn't successful at everything, things I did that I was able to be successful at were about because I had this, I was part of this network of people and CDFIs who were doing remarkable, innovative things. And I was just fortunate enough to sit in the seat where I got to see the connections a little more readily than others. So that was all. I just wanted to respond to that. So the question was, what were the challenges?
What was most challenging for you when you were doing the work at OFN? Or
Without a doubt. The most challenging thing was being able to be as disciplined, keep our discipline of mission as we build up the systems and discipline of managing money, right? Huh. And there's a story that I've told now for longer than I remember, but it is the founding story of the CDFI industry, as far as I'm concerned, which is that a lot of the early money came from orders of women religious. After large religious faith-based institutions invested, orders of women religious and religions invested. And these are self-organized communities, self-funded communities who are living on a collective financial basis. So whatever money they brought in, they put into a pot. It paid for food, it paid for housing, it paid for healthcare, paid for whatever. Right? And early on, by the late 70s and early 1980s, people like Sister Corrine Florek and many others were starting to invest their community money, the money that they needed to live on, into these things called CDFIs. So we didn't call them CDFIs yet, but into these things that were out there. And at the time, there was no lender. There was nobody who had any experience as a lender, let alone a financial manager or an asset manager. Most of us didn't have financial statements, so there wasn't a lot to look at there. And we were doing something that common sense said didn't work. And they were not only were they doing that, but they were lending their money, their community collective money, at 0% and 1% and 2% at a time when interest rate history, prevailing interest rates were 15 and 18 and 20 and 22 and 25%. Yeah. So they were taking huge losses over what they could do if they just put the money in the bank, right? Sure. And, I really call that the great act of faith that made the CDFI industry today. But the lesson of that and the most important lesson today, like it was 30 years ago and every moment in between, is that if you're lending the sisters retirement money, one, you better do something really important with it. They're not giving up, making concessions so that you can invest in, Fannie Mae bonds, for example. Not that that was an option at the time. But the other thing is, you don't ever, ever, ever lose the nun's retirement money. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So that was that discipline of mission and that discipline of money. Used to be easier. There was a presumed discipline of mission that was an impact that was really strong and prevailing. And the lagging thing was the discipline of money. Now we've become driven more and more with bank money, with government money. We've become more conservative about how we manage money. And unfortunately, I think we've become more conservative about how we think about mission. And to me, the number one issue and the thing that I tried to preach about for going back to 2012 and 2013 was our risk was not that we were going to lose people's money. Our risk was not that we were going to make bad loans. We knew how to do all that. Our risk was that we were going to have mission drift. And I think we do.
Okay.
So I think the challenge is really understanding why it makes a difference that we're doing this.
Because otherwise. Good point. So what do you love most about this work? What keeps you fighting the fight?
The people. The thing that I loved all the years I was at OFN and before I was at OFN, and I don't get to see as much today, but I still love. In fact, I didn't get to see it as much by the time the last few years of OFN because of we were victims of our own success, is in our business, you have to wake up every day saying, I'm going to do something impossible today, right? You got to, right? Because otherwise you'll go do the easy things, the low-lying fruit.
Right.
But CDFIs exist to do something, to do impossible things. If we're not trying to do impossible things, we don't have a reason to be. It's not just, can we do a loan to some, you know, can we, it is worthwhile and absolutely, you know, you'll sleep well at night if you know you gave one person a chance, right?
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful
power
thing,
there.
Especially if like you, you get to, you know, meet with them and sit with them, right?
Right.
But it can never be just about that. We live, we exist because we're in a system, a financial system bounded by rules and laws and regulations that are working, not always working with and sometimes working against the very people and communities we're trying to help. So if we're not looking outward, if we're not taking responsibility for creating some broad, better common good, then I don't think CDFIs are really fulfilling the work that they're So I woke up every day, people rightly accuse me sometimes of worrying too much about the transformational systems change, and sometimes not enough about the, you know, what the deals that had to get done. And they're right. And if you're running a CDFI or you're lending in a CDFI, you need to be really focused, hyper focused on that person and that deal. So.
But we all have our roles, right? And we all together that we need somebody focusing there and somebody focusing elsewhere. So. Well, so just one last question. We'll wrap up. So do you have any sage advice for newly minted CRA officers or community development professionals in the space?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that the people, you know, I told you earlier, I'm Generation 1B. One of the things that people in Generation 1A, including Martin Trimble, who I mentioned, and a few other people did was they understood. Let me step back from that one second.
Yep.
I think the biggest mistake most community development leaders make, most CDFI leaders make, and I've seen it happen again and again and again, it happens 99 times out of 100, is that they don't plan for success. They prepare to defend against failure, but they don't prepare for success. And so one of the things that, if you go back to some of the earliest comments, and this is the thing, these are the things that hooked me into this industry. The earliest people in this industry, when they had, at the very first time they gathered, they had aggregate in the whole industry $27 million, and most of it was in one institution, right? And they had no doubt. I mean, they might not have said it this way. They had no doubt they were going to be a $150 billion industry someday. They had no doubt that banks would turn to them for help with learning, knowing how to do so. They had no doubt, right? But so those people understood that we needed to we needed to be brutally honest about what we were doing, and we needed to be quantitative about what we were doing. And the moment we started telling ourselves we were something we were in trouble. And if we didn't have the data to base our thinking and our decision-making on, and to ask other people like CRA officers to base their decisions and their thinking on, if we didn't have that, then there's no point in doing it. You know, unwind it all, go back to 1982 or something, right? And so they got very quantitative. They understood what people needed. They understood that it was a 10 or 20 or 30 year educational process. We had to learn, they had to learn, we had to learn together. Some places they've done a really wonderful job and they've been able to do that. Some places, I said in Bloomington, folks there, the bankers I met there are fabulous community bankers. They care deeply about their community. They're doing everything they can. They're learning now there's more they can do. And they're asking all the right hard questions. It's a lot easier to answer them now because you can look at a whole data set that the CDFI fund has or Urban Institute has. And those bankers who were sitting behind me in Princeton in 1993 who said, "You're lying," they don't say that anymore.
They don't say it anymore.
You know, and so I think, you know, I think CRA officers and CDFI leaders need to meet in the middle and sort of say, this is how we think about it. How do you think about it?
Right.
And have that conversation.
Good questions, right.
One of the things that I'll end on, or try to end on, if I can stop myself from talking, is that in that first gathering in 1985, Chuck Mathai, who I mentioned earlier, who was sort of the Johnny Appleseed of the CDFI world, and people don't know him today, and it's a shame because we would not be here today if it weren't for Chuck. None of us would be. And he passed away many years ago now. But Chuck was you know, visionary. But Chuck understood that you know, what we really needed to do was to use capital to bring people together. Hmm. And the capital had the ability. He talked about it. His comments from 1985, which I could send you, but they're available on my website.
Yes, please. Website.
he understood that when you're talking about financing things, you get people from the left and the right together. You get men and women together. You get people of different races and ethnicities together. You get bonds that happen that wouldn't happen on the job otherwise. It wouldn't happen in their neighborhoods. It wouldn't happen where they go shopping, right? And, you know, the power of what we do is the ability to bring people together. And in a world that's pulling apart, it's a lesson we need to remember, that we're doing this because we can weave fabric that wouldn't otherwise exist.
Oh, well, we're so thankful that you have spent your life's work in this and will continue to do so. And
yeah, I'm not done.
You are not done. I have a lot more for you to do, let me tell you.
Right.
You know, we're just so thankful for your leadership in this space. And I just can't thank you enough, and hope to have many more conversations with you and your colleagues as we continue to fight this good fight of bringing everybody together. So
thank you so much
for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's really been a pleasure. And as you said, I don't have any trouble talking about this subject.
But I love it.
The thing that's really remarkable, you know, you asked me earlier, I answered this even though you didn't ask it. I decided to get involved in this field because of the people. People in this industry are brilliant. They're determined. They're creative. They're innovative. They don't give up.
It takes a special kind of person, that's for sure.
It does. And I think that, you know, there are plenty of opportunities. And what we found is there are deep wells of talent and deep wells of mission commitment. So I just think it's really exciting that there are folks out there who say they want to knock on the door and come in and work in this industry, because we're lucky.
Do it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's get to work.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Good.
Thanks for listening to the CRA Podcast with Linda Lewis-Izuka. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, cratoday.com, to your friends and colleagues. Don't forget to leave us a positive review on iTunes, and be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous podcasts. This has been a Linda Lewis-Izuka production. Join us next time for another edition of the CRA Podcast.